All right, everybody ready to proceed on our next matter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, give us one second. All right, and do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Great, all right. You can get started whenever you're ready.
Justice Perry-Gary, Justice Herndon, Justice Lee, may it please the court. My name is Christy Holston. I represent appellant Nathan Chasinghorse. The procedural errors of an improper grand jury instruction and failure to present exculpatory evidence doomed this indictment, and it must be dismissed. But also, the facts in this case do not support probable cause for these charges, and so I want to start by talking about consent to sex. It is not the law in Nevada that unequal power dynamics per se create sex assault. The state's theory of non-consent revolves around unequal power dynamics because Nathan is a spiritual authority. But the Nevada legislature already criminalizes sex between parties with unequal power dynamics in different offenses besides sex assault. For example, sex between a student and a teacher, or sex between a young teenager and an adult with a significant age disparity. The authority, the teacher's authority over the student does not invalidate the student's consent to sex. That's why it is not sex assault. That's why it's a separate crime. Similarly here, Nathan's spiritual authority over his followers does not invalidate their consent to sex. And that's why his spiritual authority alone and the unequal power dynamics cannot create the basis of a sex assault.
But should that be a factual determination for a jury to decide, or a grand jury if they're considering an indictment? Because there's not really any per se legal statute or case that deals with that.
No, Your Honor, it shouldn't be a question for the jury because it still has to meet that threshold of probable cause. And specifically for the members of the grand jury, they found probable cause when there was none, because the unequal power dynamics doesn't create it. They found probable cause when there was none because of the grooming instruction. So I want to talk about the grooming instruction. Now, I say grooming instruction kind of as a shorthand way of referring to it, but it was actually evidence and not an instruction. And we know that because a jury instruction is the law that the jurors must apply to the facts, whereas expert testimony is evidence that the jury is free to reject. And I want to take a minute here to highlight the fact that grand jury proceedings are done in secret without the procedural protections of a defense attorney or a judge to make sure they're conducted fairly. And so that's why it's so important that judges don't tolerate these kind of errors in the grand jury proceedings. I mean, I don't think there's a legitimate controversy as to whether it was appropriate for the state to give this grooming description to the members of the grand jury. And so this court's decision in Clay says that the inquiry now is on the effect the improper instruction had on the integrity of the proceedings. And the state's brief answers this question for us, because the state admitted that their grooming instruction was offered to assist in determining whether the conduct amounted to a sex assault. And that's the exact answer that we have to, that's the exact question that we have to answer in this case. The state also admitted in their brief that the instruction was offered to inform the grand jury how grooming can be used to obtain a victim's submission. Again, the distinction between submission and consent is central to the state's theory in this case. And so that's how we know that this improper grooming instruction led the members of the grand jury to return probable cause when there was none. And so next I want to talk about the exculpatory evidence in this case. CCH's statements to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and on Facebook demonstrate the reason that she chose to have sex. That's why they are exculpatory. Now, the state claims they're not exculpatory because they don't tend to explain away the charge and because they're merely inconsistent statements under this court's decision in Lay. So first I'll talk about the statements and then I'll talk about why the state's wrong. For the time period covering counts 4 through 17, CCH said that she was in love with Nathan, that she wanted to live with Nathan, she wanted to marry Nathan. She publicly and privately declared her love for him. CCH pursued the relationship with Nathan even when he was reluctant. Finally, CCH says that she gave Nathan an ultimatum in an effort to force him to allow her to move in with him. Now, these statements explain away the charge because they demonstrate her romantic motive to have sex and the situation that she was pursuing the relationship with him. They also demonstrate why we know it was consent instead of mere submission. And finally, they're not inconsistent statements, because she did tell the members of the grand jury that she was in love with him. That statement just wasn't good enough to represent this exculpatory evidence because it didn't clarify the time period with which she was in love with him and the depth of her pursual of the relationship. Specifically for counts 1 through 3, that's the very first sexual encounter between Nathan and CCH. CCH says that she agreed to that sex with Nathan and that she felt it was her choice. She says she did not feel bad about her choice. She felt proud of her choice, and she felt that it was an honorable choice.
And is that because she believed that it would cure her mother of cancer if she did this with him, because that's what he told her?
I think that's what the state's theory is based on, yes, Your Honor. And that's another demonstration of why that grooming instruction was so detrimental to the jury's finding.
Wasn't she also told the spirits would make her go crazy if she didn't submit?
Actually, Your Honor, I believe the record indicates that she was told that, or she testified that she was told the spirits would make her go crazy if she told anybody about the sex that they had.
Oh, that's right.
And I think that's an important distinction, right? Because it certainly wasn't a threat to engage in the sex. And I don't think there are any threats alleged in this case.
Well, there was some evidence, I think, to suggest that he implied that her mother's cancer would return if she did not continue to engage in these sexual activities with him. Is that correct?
Again, I think he did not say that. I think she assumed that, or I think she made that assumption. And I think that goes to these spiritual consequences that the state mentions in their brief. But an undefined concern of some vague and intangible consequence also cannot invalidate consent. I mean, the types of spiritual concerns mentioned by the state lack the specificity and temporal proximity to the sex act. So I don't think they can invalidate consent to sex in this case either.
Let me go back to the issue of the statements to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Facebook postings and those not being admitted. One of the concerns I have is that the court's order seems to take a very broad view in saying it wouldn't explain away the charges, without any kind of more narrowed focus on there are a series of charges that are pled as occurring related to events occurring over time, right? Some in Las Vegas, some in other states, some are the first time they have an encounter, some are later on in the relationship. My concern is that the need to disclose potentially exculpatory, not just exculpatory, but potentially exculpatory evidence doesn't need to explain away all the charges. I mean, it could explain away 15 of the 18 charges, or it could explain away only 2 of 20 charges, whatever it may be. And there doesn't really seem to be an analysis of how those might have affected various time frames of the charges.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I couldn't agree more. And I think that as I broke down the exculpatory evidence, we can see how different statements she makes applies to the different categories of charges. But you're absolutely right. If we took each count one by one and said, well, do we think that her love for him, which she says happened during the time period of count 5, for example, do we think that that tends to explain away the charge of sex assault? I think the answer would obviously be yes. So I do agree that that's why it would be helpful to do an analysis of each charge and why the exculpatory evidence explains away each charge. But absolutely, it would have been mandatory for the state to present that, even if it tended to explain away one of the charges. And that's why this indictment must be dismissed for the failure.
Even with the evidence that was presented, I mean, the standard is pretty low, what we're talking about right here. Are you saying that there's not at least slight or marginal evidence that the victims did not manifest consent, or that he should have known that they were incapable of resisting or understanding the nature of his conduct?
Yes, Your Honor. And specifically for the element of Nathan's knowledge of non-consent. That is an essential element of sex assault. And there was not even slight or marginal evidence presented that
why
he
would
knew.
He, again, going back to my last comment, if he didn't want her to tell anybody, what doesn't that indicate that she shouldn't tell anybody because she didn't consent and it was improper?
Well, there might be a lot of reasons why someone would want to keep their sexual relationship secret that don't have to do with sex assault, right? And I think that could include the fact that he was with other people, or maybe her mom didn't approve. I mean, there's just a variety of reasons why that might be the case. I think I have reached my limit to reserve.
Sure. Is your analysis any different as to the other purported victim, SB?
It's mostly the same, although obviously the facts are different. Okay. SB was 19 years old. The circumstances leading to her coming to meet with Nathan are completely different. But also, certainly there is not probable cause of a sex assault for that count against SB.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Rolls? I believe we're in the afternoon now. So good afternoon, Justice Perigary. Good afternoon, Justice Herman. Good afternoon, Justice Lee, counselors. My name is William Rolls. I represent the real party in interest in the state of Nevada in this matter. If it pleases the court, there is a reason why this court has repeatedly declined to use the power of the writ of mandamus to determine issues of consent, to determine issues of probable cause, to review a district court's determination at this stage of the proceedings. In Koosman v. Clark County, 96, Nevada 544, this court declined to entertain a petition that was not a purely legal issue. And that's exactly what's happening here with regards to the issue of consent. Mr. Chasing Horse is asking you to make a judgment call at this stage of the proceedings, when consent is a question of fact that should be left for the trier of fact.
Well, it's a little more than just the consent issue, right? And I think what we've clearly said in the past is you don't really have an adequate or speedy remedy to wait for a trial that could potentially then make grand jury errors harmless, right? Because if there is improper presentation of evidence or a failure to present evidence that should have been presented at a grand jury proceeding, all that kind of gets cleaned up at a trial, making the grand jury kind of irrelevant at that point.
I understand your point with regards to the maybe not having a speedy remedy, having had to wait, or it could be cured on direct appeal. But the entire presentation of evidence, and one of the reasons as to why courts decline to consider probable cause challenges at this stage, the entire presentation of the state's evidence is not presented at the grand jury proceedings. Not every witness, not every detective, not every investigator. If you look at the district court proceedings, in this case, the minute orders, there are several ongoing litigation motions that are being presented to the district court once this court makes its decision that all go to issues of guilt or innocence that are not presented to the grand jury. So I don't think it's proper at this stage of the proceeding for this court to make a determination that the district court erred in finding probable cause regarding consent when the burden is slight or marginal evidence and the state is not required to negate every single inference that is presented, not required to present a defense to every single inference that could be drawn during the presentation of the grand jury proceedings. And that's why I think this court has consistently declined to entertain petitions that are essentially issues for the trier of fact at this stage of the proceedings.
So I agree that the burden is very low at this stage, but there are certain things that you do have to do at this stage, right? One of which is to present exculpatory evidence. And I'm concerned about counsel's statement over here that said that certain evidence was not included that may have potentially negated the charges that were being brought. What do you say to that?
So I think the state did present exculpatory evidence, and my response to that would be is
whether we say it's one time, whether we say that she said she loved him three times, whether she said that she loved him seven times is not relevant to the proceedings. The grand jury testimony had both testimony from Corinna and Sierra regarding their love for this man, regarding their infatuation for this man. Corinna told the grand juries that she thought she was in love with him. You heard testimony that at a certain point in Corinna's life, she married Mr. Chasing Horse. You heard testimony and evidence, information was presented to the grand juries that prior to Sierra's sexual assault, that she had been communicating with Mr. Chasing Horse during that summer, saying that she loved him, saying that she wanted to be with him. So the grand jurors heard exculpatory evidence. They heard information regarding these two individuals' love and infatuation for this man.
So if you think you were putting that on, why would you not have put on the statements that were made to the Bureau of Indian Affairs or the Facebook postings?
At that time, my understanding is correctly, is that was not something that we had fully realized at the time. And so we were provided a list of information for exculpatory information as well as our own investigation to present to the grand jury. There were several things that we read at the request of the defense, but my response to that would, if it was in our file at that time, we did not appreciate the full exculpatory value of that particular statement. And that's cited in Mayo v. Clark County, an opinion that the Supreme Court had cited or had issued here. And if you look at Mayo v. Clark County, they say it's...
Wait, so you had the statement?
I do not know off the top of my head if we had the statement at that time. I think it was something that we came in after the fact. But my point is, and I correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to say we did or we did not. Okay. I don't think that's a relevant analysis at this point in the time. Because if you look at Mayo v. Clark County, they had mentioned that there was the remedy for dismissal of a grand jury indictment for not presenting exculpatory information was a very extreme remedy that should be used very lightly. But it goes on to say that at the stage of the grand jury proceedings, you are having a situation where this is a preliminary investigation. The district attorney's office or the state of Nevada may have stuff in their file that is coming in on a daily basis, and Mayo addresses this. They may have it in their file, but do they truly appreciate the exculpatory nature of it? Because Mayo understood that a grand jury investigation, a grand jury proceeding, is at the very beginning stages of the investigation. But we did present exculpatory information regarding their love. And I also don't really agree that that information is exculpatory and not an inconsistent statement.
Let me stop you for a moment, and I alluded to this with Ms. Folsom, but this is another concern I have with the argument being made and with the judge's order. It kept referring to exculpatory evidence instead of potentially exculpatory evidence. And there, it's semantics, but it's an very important distinction. It's not for the prosecutor to decide whether it's exculpatory because you don't know how jurors may view it or what the potential defenses may be. It's a very, very, very low floor. If it's potentially exculpatory at all, I got to turn it over. I got to disclose it. I got to present it, right? Because you don't know how somebody may use it. So I take issue with continuing to refer to it as I don't think it was exculpatory. That's not the standard.
I understand, Your Honor. So if you look at the district court order, when they're addressing this issue, they spent a large part about Lady State and how this was inconsistent statements. So I understand that it could be semantics when she says it's exculpatory, but her analysis is really under whether this was an inconsistent statement made that should have been presented to the grand jury. So I do disagree that she's holding that those statements are purely exculpatory.
Well, but a victim in a sex assault allegation could say to the police that I didn't consent that I was sexually assaulted. And then make an inconsistent statement later that says it wasn't sexual assault, I consented. Would you say that inconsistent statement isn't also potentially exculpatory? I mean, if it says a crime did not occur?
So in that factual scenario, I think is a little different than the scenario we have here.
No, this is just kind of hypothetically. I mean, how we interpret a victim saying a crime didn't occur is inconsistent from saying it did occur, but it's also potentially exculpatory.
So if an individual tells police that a sexual assault occurred, or the other way around, that they tell police that a sexual assault did not occur, and then later they say, no, I was wrong, this is sexual assault.
Yeah.
I would think that's an inconsistent statement.
Okay.
And not subject to being presented through exculpatory evidence Whether the district attorney's office or the state presents that statement is a different story, but I would believe that's an inconsistent statement.
So a victim saying a crime didn't occur doesn't explain away the charge?
It's an inconsistent statement if she later goes on to discuss the fact that a crime did occur.
It could be both, right? I mean,
but I don't think that's what happened here in this particular situation. There's not a time period in which we have specific situations where the victims, the information they wanted presented, are saying, this did not happen. I was not subject to sexual penetration. What they're saying is in the major aspect of things, the Facebook post is probably the biggest one, where it says, I was proud of my decision of having sex with Mr. Chasing Horse back when I was 14 years of age. You know why she's proud of that decision? Because she fully believed that giving her virginity to that man saved her mother's life. So I don't think that's inconsistent with what she's telling the grand juries. I had sex with him. I loved him. I was feared. I was told that if I did not do this, my mother would die. My mother would not seek help for her cancer treatment. And she testified throughout the entire grand jury proceedings that that persistence, and I can find a site for you, continued throughout their entire time together. Let me pull it up just one second. I apologize. I have the pin site. .237, .238, .252 She continues to tell the grand juries that throughout her entire relationship with Mr. Chasing Horse, that feeling she had back then, that hopelessness that she had to save her mother, continued. The promise that he made her, the promises that he and the grandfathers had during their relationship, he continued to remind her of that. So I don't think that that's a situation where her saying, I was proud of my decision, is her saying, like Justice Hernan said, that a crime did not occur. Okay. I fully believe that a person can be sexually assaulted and be proud of their decision to submit to that sexual assault. For a situation, say, hey, a man comes up with a gun to the head, have sex with me, you're going to die. The person's going to submit to that sexual assault. As bad as it is, they may be proud of their decision in hindsight to submit, to understand, to go through what they were going through. And that's exactly what happened in the situation. If you look at the grand jury proceedings with regards to the issue of consent, both Sierra and Corinna testified that they met Mr. Chasing Horse at a very young age, that he used his position within their community, within their culture, to gain access to them, to make them pipe carriers, to make them pure. He taught, he told them how they could dress. He told them how they could wear their hair. He told them not to wear makeup. He told them what to do. And Corinna testified during the grand jury proceedings that Mr. Chasing Horse had commented on her pureness. Sierra testified during the grand jury proceedings that Mr. Chasing Horse's helpers had sort of introduced the topic of sex to them with Mr. Chasing Horse in order to save their spirits, in order to support their souls, in order to live a pure life. And so when we go to the issue of whether those statements are exculpatory, I don't believe so. I don't think the district court's order really addresses whether those are exactly exculpatory because of the analysis she does underlay.
Which leads into the grooming instruction.
Right.
Why wasn't that improper?
So I don't think we need to address whether that grooming instruction was improper or not improper. I disagree with the district court's ruling that the grooming instruction was improper, but the analysis...
It's not an element of the offense, and including that as an instruction.
So, oh, I apologize. Let me pull that up. So I understand the court's position that it's not an element of the offense. The point I would make to this court, the response I would make is, if you look at several of the other instructions that are presented to the grand jury that Mr. Chasing Horse takes no issue with, we instruct the grand jury that submission is not the equivalent of consent. We instruct the grand jury that a victim is not required to do more than their age, strength, surrounding circumstances make it necessary to manifest opposition. They take issue with this instruction because it's most directly on point. If we're looking at NRS 200-366, there's nothing in the plain statute of that text where a layperson can read, oh, submission is not the equivalent of consent. But this court has routinely upheld, and they take no issue with other instructions that deal with instructions that help assist a trier of fact in determining consent.
Well, separate from whether they challenged any others, I mean, one of the things we said in Perez was, okay, state, you can present grooming testimony in a trial with an expert, right? You can't just present lay people on this issue. And here, we didn't present anybody on the issue. And unlike a jury trial, where you get jury instructions at the end of the case, at the grand jury, the jurors are given the instruction at the beginning of the case. So they read through this instruction about grooming as if it's going to be part of this presentation, and then they hear evidence. So it seems somewhat indefensible to me that this instruction is given.
So my response would be to that would be, one, I disagree that the grooming instruction cannot be given at this stage of the proceedings. But then if this court finds that that was an improper instruction, the analysis then switches to like what this court did in Clay, where they found an improper instruction. Was there still probable cause? Was there still sufficient evidence to support a grand jury indictment? And the district court did that. So your analysis isn't whether the grooming instruction was wrong. Your analysis is now whether the district court erred in still finding probable cause despite the grooming instruction. And that's what the district court's analysis was. And she said, despite this, there's still probable cause. And that's exactly what this court did in Clay. The Clay, they found, hey, physical injury was not defined. But despite that happening, there was still sufficient evidence for one of the counts to survive a challenge to the grand jury indictment. So my response to you is, if you find that instruction to be error, then the analysis is, despite it, is there still sufficient evidence? Not even that. The analysis is whether the district court manifestly abused her discretion. Did she act randomly? Did she do it sort of in the heat of the moment? And I don't believe that's true. This was, if you look at her order, she went through several aspects of the case to still support her decision finding probable cause. And so your analysis, Justice Hernan, would be, was her discretion abused? And I don't believe that's true.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
All right, thank you. All right, Ms. Olson.
Ms. Olson, may I just ask a question right out of the gate because it's fresh in my mind. As to the exculpatory Facebook post and all of the evidence, would it just have been redundant? Because my understanding, based on review of the record and further underscored by counsel, is that she testified, both defendants, victims testified to exactly what these extraneous documents said. So would it have just been cumulative? Is there really any prejudice here?
I don't think it would be cumulative, Your Honor, or redundant, because the statement that CCH made in the grand jury, first of all, was after her testimony had mostly concluded about the specific facts, but also because it really just the sentence, "I believed I was in love with him," does not convey the depth of the way that she pursued the relationship, or again, the time period for which she fell in love with him, right? That's incredibly important because in her interview with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, she explains that she started falling in love with him right after that first sexual encounter. So that would have started with count 4. So counts 4 all the way through 17 would be covered by the time period that she claims to have been in love with him. Obviously, her romantic desire for him tends to explain away the charge, and it would have been important to clarify for the members of the grand jury the time period for which she held those feelings. And also, it's a different thing to say, "I'm in love with someone," than it is to say in an interview to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, "I pursued the relationship with him more than he was pursuing it with me."
What about for counts 1 through 3? Does that have any bearing on those?
I don't believe those particular statements have bearings on count 1 through 3. But specifically for counts 1 through 3, which might be a harder question, the fact that she specifically says she agreed to the sex, again, that's not inconsistent with what she told the grand jury because she didn't tell the grand jury that she didn't agree to the sex. But if you're trying to determine whether someone consented or did not consent, hearing them say, "I agreed to the sex," really makes a big distinction. And so I think it would have been absolutely necessary for them.
Are you trying to, is it our place to supplant our factual findings for those of the grand jury after they listened to all of the evidence and the testimony? I mean, should we be injecting ourselves into that factual analysis?
In this case, yes, I think that's an easy decision, both because the grooming instruction was so prejudicial and so inappropriate, And again, it's a policy argument for why we should be protecting the grand jury proceedings, but also because in this case, there simply was not probable cause to support a charge of sex assault. And that, I think that's clear from the evidence. It's clear from the theories that the state advances in their brief that just as a matter of law, do not create probable cause for a sex assault. And I also think it's important that the court decides that issue. Even if the court finds that, you know, the exculpatory evidence must have been presented, or the potentially exculpatory evidence must have been presented. And so maybe the court might wonder why it even needs to reach the question of probable cause. And that's important because in this case, there's also another reason for mandamus relief is the question of statewide importance at issue in this case in determining what conduct can invalidate consent to sex. That's an important question to answer because allowing such vague, intangible concerns to invalidate consent risks making it hard to tell what conduct is actually criminalized under our sexual assault statute. It also risks over-criminalizing sex because these concepts are impossibly broad and varied under the state's theory.
Well, and again, going back to the standard, slight or marginal evidence, and for us to interject ourselves at this point, assuming this goes on, the jury will hear all of this.
That's right, Your Honor, but I think it's inappropriate for a jury to hear evidence when it doesn't even pass the threshold of probable cause. And so I wonder that if we risk just being back here again after the trial. I see my time has run out.
Quick last question for you. I don't recall, and I apologize to both sides if I'm wrong, anywhere in the briefing that the state taken the position that they didn't have the Bureau of Indian Affairs statements or the Facebook posts at the time of the grand jury proceedings. What is your understanding of that?
I got the interviews that CCH gave to the Bureau of Indian Affairs from the prosecutors before they went to the grand jury. That's where I got that evidence. So they did have that evidence. And specifically, the Facebook post is what initiated this investigation in the first place. The detective saw the Facebook post and then started to investigate. So certainly the state had possession of those things. Right. Unless there are any more questions, I will thank the court so much for the extra time.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you both very much. I appreciate your argument today, as well as a very well done briefing, and this matter will stand.